this is an interview with Mr. Barney Maguire, and it's the 5th of March, 1965, right? Just for the record, so we know who I'm talking to now. I think that, really, you've been around, and I think, why don't you give me your picture of the, what you know of the mining, metal mining unions, what you've picked up, and if you can give me, now a lot of your information comes from old-timers, doesn't it?
From where?
Old-timers that you've met.
Yes,
you were
yes.
directly involved in it, but
yes.
you met these people.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Why don't you just try giving us a sort of an outline, and then when we get to something I'll ask you more questions.
Yes.
Right from the start, almost, what you know of it.
Well, as a person who started working in the mining camps in 1933, and then in 1946 I started working as an organizer for the Mine, Mill and Smelter Workers Union, and from 1946 until 1963 I worked different times for that organization as an organizer in all parts of BC, in the Yukon, the Northwest Territories, and down east. And my first recollection of any union activity in the mines, that is that I was fairly close to, was the Antioch strike in 1933. I was just starting to work at Alice Arm at that time, which is about 18 miles away. And then I went to work in the mines up in Bridge River from 1933 to 1935. And then I worked in the mines from 1935 to 1937 in the Salma, Weimer, Nelson, Slocan area. And it was while I was in that area that I first became associated with the Mine, Mill and Smelter Workers Union when I was working at the Weimer Yankee Girl Mine. And in the winter of 1936, we applied for a charter from the Mine Mill Union, and the charter number that we received was Local 300. So you can see that Local 300, it was definitely one of the old-time locals. Now, prior to that, in 1935, Local 271, Mine Mill and Smelter Workers, was chartered at Braylorn, and it was the oldest number that is in recent years that was chartered. Now you take the number 271, and there was two charters granted around the Nelson country, one Salma, one Weimer, and they were 300 and 301, if I'm not mistaken. And now we see we're back in 1937, I believe it was, that Local 480 at Trail was chartered. And then I don't think there was any other mine mill locals chartered in BC until 1943. And then the first one was Copper Mountain, the second one was Britannia. Pardon me. And then from there on, I mushroomed out all throughout the province.
Yeah. Now, let's go right back to the early days. Just to start off, I got a... There was a local of the Knights of Labor in Rosslyn around the turn of the century. I was wondering, and when I read about this, it struck me, were the Knights of Labor in the mine, were the, those miners? Do you know anything about the Knights of Labor?
Yes. Now, in talking with old-timers that was in the Western Federation of Miners, and just as an example, George Casey, who's secretary of the Roslyn Miners Union, about 1904, and it was at that time that they lost a strike there. He left. I happened to be a sort of a family friend of the Casey family. He went to Prince Rupert after he left Roslyn. I was raised just north of Prince Rupert. Now also,
did he say there was something?
Yes, he mentioned to me that as a part of the formation of the Western Federation of Miners, it was composed of a number of small unions from different parts of the United States, and also that their main membership came from the Knights of Labor. Now, this can also be authenticated by this book here, Big Bill Haywood's book. Now, he tells of the formation of the Western Federation of Miners, and he repeats that remark in there, that they mainly came from the Knights of Labor. And of course, when they were set up, the Western Federation of Miners, like 1893, they took in coal mines and everything in the mining industry upon an industrial basis.
Mm-hmm. Well, in BC, in the Western Federation of Miners, miners and the Knights of Labor were the first ones in the local mine.
Yes, that's that is my understanding, that amongst the first unions of the miners in British Columbia would be the Western Federation of Miners and the Knights of Labor. And also from other old-timers that I have spoken to, the Western Federation of Miners, it went out of existence in the years from approximately 1915 to 1920, and they were replaced in a good many of the camps by the industrial workers of the world.
Which camps?
Well, primarily, my understanding was in the slow cam that the IWW, they took over from the Western Federation of Miners. I understand they took over their hall there at Sandon. The hall at Sandon, they took over it from the Western Federation. And in recent years, when that hall was more or less, you might say, rediscovered by the Mine Mill Union, I seen some of the records that come out of that hall, and they were mostly records from the IWW. There were very few, if any, records of the Western Federation in that hall. That is the records that I seen that come out of the Miners' Hall in Sandon.
Where else? Do you know any other specific places?
Yes, I understand that. No, I really don't know of any other places where the IWW took over from the Western Federation of Miners. Other than that, they were organized in a good many other industries and places throughout the province. But I don't know specifically of any place other than that they took over from the Western Federation of Miners.
Why do you think the Western Federation of Miners declined?
Well, to quote you from Big Bill Haywood's book, he states that one of the reasons for the decline in membership of the Western Federation of Miners was that had turned from a previously militant union to virtually a company union. Now, he states that right in here, as I said, right in this book here. And he tells of the differences that he had with the leadership of the Western Federation of Miners. And the Western Federation of Miners, they finally they issued a statements to the effect that Haywood was no longer connected with the Western Federation of Miners and that he didn't speak on their behalf. All of which is authenticated in here, and I believe some of these statements are even quoted that the Western Federation of Miners issued regards Haywood. And I can well remember back in 1936 in the Salmo-Weimar area when we first joined the Mine Mill Union, we were being questioned by some of the old timers there as to what union it was that we were going to join. And we told them that, well, as far as we know, it's the Mine Mill and Smelter Workers Union. We need a union, that's all we know. Well, he said, is that the same union that was in the Slocan several years ago? And we said, yes, we checked and we found out that that was so. And, well, he said, if that is the case, he said, that's the union that scabbed on us in the Slocan. And that would be in the years from about 1916 to 1919. And I'm not too sure just which mine that was where he said this took place, but I do know that we had a lot of difficulty in healing that there split from the past amongst the miners at that particular time. Now, in the Nelson area, which you can include like the Spokane, the Salmo, Weimar area, there was never the same type of unionization in the 30s and in the 40s as there was in other parts of the province. Now, I'll give you an example. In 1935, the miners and the Bridge River were out on strike. They went out on strike. You might say without a union, they had an independent organization first. And then in 1937, the miners at Wells went out on strike. And then in 1939, the miners in the Bridge River were out on strike again. Now, here's something that is highly significant that bears out what I'm saying. In Bridge River, the rate was, after 1935, the rate of pay of the miners was approximately 65 cents a day higher than the rate of pay of the miners in Wells, in the Caribou. And the rate of pay of the miners in Nelson was traditionally 50 cents a day less than in the Caribou. So there was quite a difference in wages. Now, if there was any justification for a union from the point of view of low wages, it would have been the Nelson, the Salmo, Weimar area that would have been spearheading this. But it wasn't, and one of the reasons that there wasn't this year unity amongst the workers there, that is not a great number of them, but the old timers, and then it brushed off to their sons and a few other people, was this here stigma from the past and the quarrels that had taken place between the Western Federation of Miners and the IWW. Now, the old timers that I spoke to in the Nelson country about that, to the best of my knowledge, they're all dead. But there were very well-known people in that country. Just to give you their names, there was a Bill Hickey, a well-known miner, a black Angus MacDonald, and a water miner, Scotty. So everybody knew those people. Anybody that was in the Slocan or anyone of recent years would know those fellows by names, and also another fellow by the name of Walter Tapry. Now this Tapry may still be living in the Slocan. He was a few years ago. I think there's another old-timer, if I'm not mistaken, who was living in Caslow. His name is Sam Nomlin, or Skookum was his nickname. He's possibly living in Caslow. He would know some of the past history of the unionization during the First World War days in that country. Now, another chap who was raised in that country, he's also here in Vancouver right at the present time. He was also one of the charter members of the Salmo local at Salmo in 1936. He's now in Vancouver, and he's working as a hiring agent for the United Kino and some other mines. Bill Butler is his name. Now this is a name, and this is a fellow that due to his position in life right now, if he were to speak about anything like this, it would have to be anonymously. I'm sure he wouldn't, and you couldn't expect him to, but he would be able to authenticate the fact that there was two locals chartered back there in 1936. And he would also know old-timers from the Slocan country, because he was raised up in the Revelstoke country, just north of Slocan. He was raised at a place called Beaton, B.C. And him and I are both the same age. We were quite young when we worked in the mines there at that particular time. Now, the reason that this was never mentioned around there very much, and the reason that people have kept this quiet, is that it was water under the bridge. It done no good to mention it whatsoever. In fact, it only hurt your own cause to mention this. So therefore, myself and others, we decided that nothing should be said about it. But this feeling, if I'm not mistaken, it's still carried over in the Slocan and Nelson area right to this very day. Now, I can well remember back from 1946 to 1948, off and on, I worked as a mine mill organizer in the area, Salvo, Weimer, and Nelson, Caslow, and so on, from my mill, that area. And it was very difficult in getting the fellas to stay together and to work together the way they should. And this was partly because of the fact that a whole number of people were living in the past, and they couldn't forget about it as much as we were trying very hard. And this is borne out by the fact that in this area, Mine Mill, at that time, they formed, well, about 1947, they formed what they call the Nelson District Miners Union, with the idea of taking in all the mines in that area in the one local union and the one business agent. And previously, they'd had different locals in all the different mines, and it was a much improved setup to have them serviced by one local man with a headquarters, say, in Nelson. And they have numerous business agents in that area. John Moffat was one of them. Ken Smith was another, who worked in there for a year. And in recent years, they've had a man there study by the name of Bill Rudichuk. Although you must remember now, the mines in the Slocan in that area, they're more or less closed, and they have been for some particular time. And I run into other old-timers that were not working in the mining industry in other parts of the province. They told me about the differences that existed between the Western Federation of Miners and the IWW. And they told me that once the IWW was taking the place of the Western Federation of Miners, another big difference they had amongst themselves was over Big Bill Haven himself, because some of them, they took the position that he had given the best years of his life to the labor movement, and his health was gone, and that therefore they should approve of him going over to the Soviet Union where he could spend the rest of his days in peace. And then the others, on the other hand, they took the position, just the extreme opposite, that he had done something very wrong in running away, not facing the music, but they had to stay there and face the music. But however, the result was that it did cause these divisions amongst the membership, his departure to the Soviet Union.
Now, do you remember, while I was still in the Western Federation, do you remember who the leaders were in British Columbia?
In the Western Federation of Miners, to begin with, their top officers were Haywood, Moyer, and Pettibone.
Yes.
And then they had board members and business agents in different at different times. There was a Davidson, who was one of their representatives. Bennett was another.
Bill Bennett?
Well, this Bennett, I have a little bit of information on him in this here book. Here, now, this book here is a record of the BC District Union from 1943 up until 1950. And it's mentioned in here about himself at one time when he was a business agent or a board member for the locals in the Slocan area, one of the arbitration cases he had at that time. It's all given in this here.
Could you find it right now?
Yes, I think I could. By the way,
no.
About the part he played in the 1939 Pioneer Miner Strike?
No, I haven't.
Well, now, Bill Cameron, Bill Cameron, a member of the Carpenters Union, a business agent in the Carpenters Union, he was one of the leaders on the 1939 sit-down strike at Pioneer. He can fill you in on that. Now, another person who can fill you in on the Wells strike, 1937, is an Orrin Ditto of Nanaimo. No, I haven't got his address here, but I can do it for you, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a chap. He's at the present time, he's about 70 years of age, and he is working at Courtney. He comes into the Nanaimo for the weekend. He's just about ready to retire. Now, if you want to authenticate the charter, which was granted in 1936 at Weimar, of all the other fellows that signed the charter application at that time, I can only think of two of them that's in a place where you could get them, and one of them is a George Bain, who was working as a miner at the Weimar Yankee Girl Mine at the same time I was. He was one of the signers of that charter, and he's now a fireman for the CMS at Trail. And he could also give you considerable history as to the union activity, or attempts at union activity, in the Sheep Creek, that is, Salma, Weimar, Nelson area, around those years, 1935-37, George Bain. Now, what happened to myself personally was that as a result of just being a union member and everybody knowing about it, and naturally the bosses, I got blackballed in BC here, which wasn't a very hard thing to have happen to you. And I couldn't get a job at any of the other mines, so I worked down east in the mines there until after 1939. Then I came back to British Columbia, and with the war on, I was able to get a job. And the first mine mill local that I was a charter member of was in Yellowknife. That was in 43, I guess, when they brought it into the into Yellowknife. There was two attempts made before we finally succeeded up there. I was later on the secretary of the local. I was business agent for a year. And then I was back in there as an organizer for my mill. Another local that I was a charter member of was the Sabellas Miners Union, Local 851, which is still in existence. I was elected secretary of that. And that's in this here book here. That was in 45, I guess it was. And then I was also a charter member of the TACU Miners Union. That was in spring of 46. I was elected their secretary. And then the strike came off, the province-wide strike, you know, of my mill throughout all the mining camps. I come down to Vancouver, and it was shortly after that that I started working as a representative for Mine Mill, and my first job with Mine Mill as an organizer was around the foundries here in Vancouver. At that time, they had, I believe it was 16 foundries organized. Today they have two. I worked for Mine Mill approximately a year. I was laid off. And during the time that I was laid off, I was also a charter member of the Spring Coulee Tuttle Miners Union, one of the charter members. I was elected secretary of that local. And then I went to work in Kimberley, and while in Kimberley, I was naturally a member of Local 651 there. And we organized the tunnel workers there for the first time. We got a good contract, good conditions of work. And then I went back to work for the mine mill as an organizer. I worked down east for them. And then I was transferred west here. And then I went to work in Yellowknife for a year as a business agent there. I quit there. I come down and I worked in Alberta in one of the tunnels there. I went down east and I worked at the Lakeshore Mine in Curtin Lake. And I only worked there a little while, and they elected me president of the mine mill local. And at that time, mine mill and steel were in a battle over membership there. And then I went back to work for a mine mill on their staff. I worked down east for a considerable period of time, and then I came back west and worked in different parts of BC. Then I was sent into Uranium City, and while I was in Uranium City, we were successful in organizing four mines in there and got certified in them. Then I went into the Yukon. I was the man that organized the Yukon. We organized United Kino and Mac Kino Mine. The United Kino Mine was quite a large operation. It had a mine, a mill camp, and then there was the drivers that used to go back and forth between Whitehorse and the mill. And at Whitehorse, there was the garage workers, about 35 or 40 of them, and then there was about 75 truck drivers. We brought them all into one unit. And then, shortly after that, I went down and I organized the Cassiar mine mill local. Shortly after that, I came to Edmonton, and it was about that time that they sent me into Lynn Lake, Manitoba. They told me they wanted to organize there, and I went into Lynn Lake, and I found out that the place was already organized by the AFL. They didn't have the best contract in the world, a fair contract. So I come on back out and I told Murphy and others that the place was under contract. The contract wasn't too bad, and that it was a closed company town. And my opinion was that to go in there would be wrong because it would be raiding, and we couldn't do it. Even if we wanted to, we couldn't take over that particular place. Well, the result was quite a difference of opinion amongst myself and the other officers in my mill, and the result was I was fired. I told them that I was willing to make an issue of it, that I wouldn't bloody well do it, and well, they said that was all they had for me. There was no other thing they had for me to do. Then I started back to work for them in 1962, I guess it was, and I finished up working for them in August, the end of August in 63. And myself, knowing the mine mill union and knowing it right from the start, how it was set up, how it operated, and knowing the men involved, the companies they had to deal with, and so on, I was firmly convinced that once they lost Sudbury, there was no other way they could stay in existence other than at the expense of the workers. Now, the setup of mine mill in Western Canada and in Canada, that is the manner in which they function from 1943 up until this present time, or let me say it this way, the manner in which they functioned prior to the time that they lost Sudbury is something that's of extreme importance, and I think it's necessary to know their method of functioning in order to have a true picture of what did happen and their position today. Now, there is no one will deny, and now this is a part of what you want to hear.
Yeah.
Now, there is no one will deny that in 1943, mine mill, they become reactivated out here in British Columbia, and in two or three years, they had all the mines organized, or just about all of them. And no one will also deny that the plans of the mine mill union was to go out on a province-wide strike in 1946 and a master agreement. That was the plans.
Hmm.
That was set up and was agreed to at conventions. Now, what happened was this. A settlement was made with the CM&S, and it was decided that they would sign that agreement there. And by the way, this is all borne out right here in this book. agreements were then signed with Trail and Kimberly. And later on, 1946, all the mines in the province of British Columbia went out on strike, and we had the policy of a master agreement, the one wage scale for all the mines in the province. Now, what happened after that was this. First of all, there was the CM&S operations that settled with two or three operations. And after the strike, there was the copper mines that settled with two or three mines there. And then after that was the base metal mines, they settled. Then after that, the gold mines settled. And there was a different wage scale in each category of mines. And the strategy of mine mill was changed from a master agreement to this strategy here, that they would pick on one mine in a particular category. They would choose the mine, the time and the place with which to strike. And they were successful in all of the strikes that they conducted in recent years. And this is how they done it, like that. And then all the other mines in that category would keep working. These other mines all over, they would contribute to support that particular mine that was out on strike. They won all their strikes. They didn't have many, but they won them. It had the effect of bringing up the rates of pay of the other mines in that category. And then the next year, they'd work it over here in base metals, copper, or whatever the case may be. Now, another part, in order to understand mine mill, that we must understand is this. As much as a lot of people don't like to call a union a business, I think that you have to face up to the fact that it's got to be an operation that makes money or it doesn't stay in existence. Now, you can break mine mill down into its larger locals and into its smaller locals. And this is what you will see about the setup of mine mill. You might say that you have particularly three locals that are financial liabilities, financial assets, and quite large financial assets. And I'm talking of prior to their loss of Sudbury now.
Which ones would they be?
Trail? Well, that'd be Trail, Kimberley, and Sudbury. And these other little properties, it would cost more to service them what they were getting from them. And this was the backbone of the organization. Now, this is very important to have this in your mind, in my way of thinking. Now, here was the strategy that they pursued from 46 on. Now, you see, they would keep all these other mines and all these other categories working. Now, plus the support from these other mines, Trail, Kimberley, and particularly Sudbury, they couldn't lose. There was no such a thing as them not being able to finance a strike. Now, I'm talking prior to the loss of Sudbury. Now, this is a setup and a method of functioning that the mine operators knew existed and worked very well for mine mill. And to a point, I think it must be said that they done quite well, and up until recent years, I think it would be an exaggeration to say that they had to exist at the expense of the workers due to that particular method of operation that they had. Now, considering their circumstances, which you must, in that, just a couple of years after this setup was set up and followed, they were expelled from the mainstream of the labor movement. And to be quite honest about it, you must admit then that they would have to get most of their support from themselves. Now, with this particular setup of mine mill, they could, and they did successfully, finance all of their strikes here in Western Canada. Now, What happened a few years ago was, and this is what I found out, that my mill, they went out on strike in Sudbury. They didn't have enough money to support the strikers in Sudbury. What they had there was, in reality, a hunger strike. And that was one of the main reasons for the workers turning against them down there. Now, shortly after the Sudbury strike, and during the time of the Gillis administration in Sudbury, and you're familiar with the time they took over there, prior to the steelworkers coming in and winning. Now, what happened out here in British Columbia was this. There was about 5 open pit mines opened in the province. Now, those open pit mines that opened in the province were Nimkish, there was Jedway, there was Bethlehem Copper, there was Phoenix, there was Craigmont, and also Kennedy Lake. Now, keeping in mind that the mine operators knew the setup of mine mill, and knowing that they knew that the backbone of mine mill was Sudbury, and also that they knew mine mill was broke, it was bankrupt as a result of the Gillis administration not sending in their per capita tax. What they done was this, they offered mine mill certifications in all of these here mines that I am telling you about. And then, once they offered them certifications, the company put pressure to bear upon mine mill for an agreement. And due to the fact that mine mill was in this position, they were able to write the kind of agreements that they wanted, right from beginning to end, and agreements that lasted well over 3 years. The idea of the agreement was that it would last over 3 years, because 3 years, once a mine starts operation, they have a tax-free period. Now, they had studied Murphy quite well, the mine operators, and they knew the setup of mine mill, and they judged it that Murphy would sign these agreements in order to plug a hole where the steelworkers might come in by. And they were absolutely 100% correct in their thinking and in their calculation as to how Murphy would react. Now, a number of the workers that had been very loyal supporters of mine mill, they took great issue with the signing of these agreements, that is, secretly, you see, with the officers in mine mill, and they raised particular cane about it. And they told them it was wrong, because as an example, at Kennedy Lake, Murphy negotiated there 12 hours, and then they come out with an agreement. They never went through a conciliation officer or a conciliation board. He flew in and out with the company personnel man who negotiated on behalf of the company. That is, they used the same airplane coming into the camp and out of the camp. This was made quite an issue of by the committee. And Murphy's big reason in convincing a lot of his loyal members, and I myself at that time I fell for it, although I sure as hell wouldn't put my name to any of those bloody agreements, but this is the argument that he came out with. We've got everything tied up in Sudbury. We're broke. We're going to win Sudbury. When we get our economic strength restored, then we'll reopen all these agreements. And we got to sign these agreements to keep the steelworkers out. And so the fellas, like he had 6 or 7 of them over there in Kennedy Lake, they agreed to signing the agreement with him. And upon that basis, he was able to get these 6 or 7 agreements signed throughout the province. Now this signing of agreements before the mine got into production was a complete reversal of their policy from the past. Now I happen to know this very well, because in the past, when I worked as a mine mill organizer, a part of my job was this. That I would watch these here mines, and as soon as the mill started, then we'd go in and organize it, and then you had bargaining power, because you had them in a 3-year tax-free period. And we would only sign a 1-year agreement, as all we would sign, or 2 years at the most. In the hopes that somebody, someplace else in the meantime, would win a higher wage, and then we'd go after them again during this tax-free period. Now, when they had the strength, and when they had the workers behind them, they were able to hold off in organizing these here places. And then they could put pressure to bear upon the companies. And I think that it's the signing of these agreements in the province that's actually going to bring the downfall of my mill, because I feel that the way a worker looks at it is this. He wants the maximum results for the dues dollars that he puts out, and the mine mill is just not able to give it to him, particularly since their loss of Sudbury. And I am of the opinion that all they are doing now is existing by virtue of the wishes of the employers. The employers are doing as they want to with them. The REMAC strike, which was during the time that they were in difficulties in Sudbury. When you study it, it was a complete hoax. I'll give you a write-up on that, and you'll see how I've authenticated the dates of the agreements and so on. And it's quite obvious that they just were not capable of financially supporting the workers. And the Britannia strike up here, it's just a complete hoax from beginning to end. In that it amounts to this, that they're willing to settle for a wage cut. They have settled for a wage cut, and this they were willing to do quite some months ago. In other words, anything to get dues dollars in to keep them alive. And my thoughts are that they cannot contribute to the welfare of the working people. And I've had many of the old-timers tell me, well, they should either go down fighting or else they should join the steel workers, either one or the other. And I'm afraid that that would be my opinion on them too at the particular time.
How much financial aid do they get? Is there any aid from the States?
You mean the mine mill at the present time?
Or is it in the same condition?
Well, they would get financial support, you know, from they would get financial support from their other locals.
Is there much?
Well, this, of course,
mine mill,
no position to know, you see. But the Britannia strike, I don't think there's any doubt about it. They are capable of financing the Britannia strike, which is not a big one, though. That isn't a big number of workers to support our own strike. There's not many there right at the present time.
What about, do you know anything about the, in the 40s there was a battle with Entrail, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Steel workers.
Yeah.
Were you in on that or
something? No, I wasn't in on that at all. That was in the, you mean 1949-50?
Yeah.
Yes, yes. No, I was never in on that. I was in Trail back in 46-47, you know, with my mill. But I was never in there during that battle between steel workers and my mill.
You don't know anything?
No, I really am not too familiar with too much of what took place there.
Okay, well, let's go back to some, I have a couple of questions in my mind. One is that the IWW, when did they stop?
When did they go out of existence?
Yes, in the mines.
I would say they went out of existence in the mines in about 1919 or 1920.
Now what about the OBU? Did a lot of them join the OBU? Or?
Yes, now this is my understanding that they did join the OBU. And I don't know, I don't think the OBU had recognition or any contracts in any of the mining camps.
And of course the IWW never had that anyway, did they?
Yes, I think they did. They got some contracts, if I'm not mistaken, in the Spokane, that is the Nelson area. I think they had contracts there and they conducted strikes in that area.
Now, okay. Do you know of any which locals of the Western Federation of Miners in BC sort of stayed on? Were there any that stayed on and joined through the 20s?
No, no, they went out of existence completely. Now, in the 1930s, be about late 1930s, they set up in Vancouver, about 1936, I guess, or 37, they set up in Vancouver a local union where all the miners could belong to and where they could come in and pay their dues. And this local was local 289, which is still in existence.
Mm-hmm.
Now 289 comes after 271, which was formed at Bray-le-Loine in 1935. And they had a man in Vancouver by the name of George Price. Now, whether or not, I think George has passed on now for some time, and he was retired back in about 1946, if I'm not mistaken, or 46 or 47, George Price retired, because I remember him quite well. But people at 1947, I guess, and George Price retired. And then, of course, Mine Mill under Murphy, they were the ones, you know, that took over his function. George, his function was to keep the union alive in the province, recruit members wherever he could. George Price was up in Bridge River in 35. I think he was also back there in 39 too, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
was he a mine mill man?
Oh, yes.
He was put there on salary?
Oh, yes. George Price was the only man they were able to maintain in BC here for quite some time. Although they did have others that worked, you see, from time to time for them.
Now, in the mines, during the 20s now, there are no unions then.
Yes.
Were there in the mines, that was to say there were no unions that had certification.
Yeah.
Were there any sort of committees, informal committees in any of the mines, or people that met and talked did you know of?
To the best of my knowledge, in fact, ever since I started working in the mines, there was always these committees and or what we would call a company union. It was not unusual at all for that type of a setup.
Well, this is the company union.
Yes, yes.
What I meant was that maybe some of the old members say the IWW, or but might try to agitate for a union.
Well,
I mean, sort of a shadow union,
mm-hmm.
But not a company union, but a.
Mm-hmm. No, to the best of my knowledge, there wasn't any of that. Although there was, attempts like in setting up like independent unions that wouldn't be company unions, like at Wells and like at Bridge River in the past. And then when the fellows would get ideas about joining a bona fide organization, well, that's when the employers wouldn't recognize them. No, I think one of the mistakes that the IWW made, they were too bloody militant, you know. And I know that the fellows, during the years that I worked in the mines prior to unionization, had we joined these here company unions and so on, I think we would have brought along legitimate unions an awful lot faster, because it would have shown up their inadequacy. And, well, what is the answer to this anyhow? And we didn't do that, though. There were not too many active in any of these so-called company unions.
Now, can you tell me anything how the mine mill then got started again? The first local was...
In B.C.?
Yeah.
Well, how it first got started was this. Harvey Murphy was working in the shipyards.
Mm-hmm.
42. Prior to that, he had spent a year in the concentration camp, you know, for, as a member of the Communist Party opposing war. And then when he got out, he went to work in the shipyards, and...
this is when? 42?
Yeah, 42. And then in 43, he started to work as a mine mill organizer. And at that time, mine mill was broken up into seven different districts, United States and Canada. Now, District 7 was composed of British Columbia, Alaska, and some of the states south of us. Number 8 district, that was Ontario East. And the board member for District Number 7 was a Chase Powers from the States, and he is the man that hired Harvey Murphy. Harvey Murphy went to him. Chase, I used to be in the Communist Party in those days. And Harvey Murphy went to Chase Powers and he said, well now, this is the time, I'm the guy. Let's go ahead. And of course Powers said, well, he said, I don't know. He said, if you can organize or not. And he said, I don't know whether time is right. So what Harvey went and done then, he went down to Longshoremen's Union, and this can be authenticated. He borrowed $1,000 from them, so he would have some money to start out, on the road. And he got it, and he started out organizing, and he went into Copper Mountain. I knew some of the fellas up there that he knew, and there was no trouble to organize at all. And then he went into Britannia, and there was a number of people up there that he had connections with, or through the Communist Party and all members of the Workers' Unity League and so on. See, that's how he got his connections. And then throughout the mining camps, they were fairly easy to organize during those years. And then local 480, and Trail, they got certified in 1944. Britannia and Copper Mountain got certified in 43. And then Kimberley followed after that. And then Pioneer, Braylorn, and Wells. And then the other mines. There was other mines like Stewart, and well, there was mines that are closed down now, like around Hazleton and a mine up along that, a mercury mine up there. Fort St. James, a mercury mine there. They got a union in there too. And of course, it just mushroomed once it started. There was no holding it back. And there was a great many changes made once the unions got in that were very, very good, you know. And I think that's one of the reasons of the great loyalty of a lot of the old-timers to this day towards my mill is the improvements they made once they got the unions in during the war years, because particularly at Copper Mountain and Britannia, where there were closed company towns, if anybody was caught receiving a big parcel from Eaton's, buying their groceries in a place other than the company store, that was reasons for dismissal, which they changed right away, you know. And then there was double deck bunks and rooms not much bigger than this. There'd be four bunks, three or four bunks, and there'd be different men on in the different bunks, three different shifts, you know. And you had to supply your own blankets. Up until about 1944, you had to pack your own blankets all over the country. There was no holidays or pay, no statutory holidays. Well, these are the improvements you see that were made just by virtue of getting a union into the camps, you might say. And these loyalties, they linger on and on. Particularly with fellows who have read nothing else other than the mine mill publications, which I think very falsely tell the history of unionization in the mining camps in the States and in Canada. It doesn't, their telling of the history of unions in the mining industry, it doesn't tell of the birth of the Western Federation of Miners, how it was an offshoot, as Haywood calls it, of the Knights of Labor, and how they were into quarrels with the United Mine Workers in some places, and how they were in quarrels with the IWW in other places. And what I mean is this, that workers will only support a union as long as that union is doing the job for them, and they don't care what the name of the union is, who its officers are, or anything like that. And I think the same thing can be said about the steel workers. If they don't do a job for the workers, then the workers are going to get somebody else, and so on. So that's my thoughts as to what will happen, and I'm sure that's what has happened in the past. They only support a union that is doing something for them. Another development here in British Columbia in the mining has been the start of the Tunnel and Rock Workers Union. Now, this is something that you should check into, too. Now, the best person who can give you the history of that, right from the beginning, and I was in on that, by the way, and that started at Comano, is Bill Slewage.
How do you spell that?
Oh, S-L-E-W-I-D-G-E. Now, Bill Slewage is a representative of the Hog Carriers Union, and I'll give you their phone number, by the way. It's Mutual 4-7021. Now, the Tunnel and Rock Workers, it started as a result of the Comano Master Agreement that was signed, you might say, in which the tunnel workers were brought under the hod carriers, and there was quite a bit of dissatisfaction over their rates and so on. And they asked my mill to come on in there, and I was sent in there. Well, the result was that the Tunnel and Rock Workers Union was set up, and there's quite a bit of history to tell about that and what has happened in years gone by since they were set up. They've done quite a good job, I would say, on behalf of the tunnel miners, how they've increased their wages and so on. And I can remember the tunnel workers' strike there when they went out on strike. That was back in, I just forget what year that was, back about 1950, I guess. They were out on strike to improve their wages, and they wanted to bring my mill in there. And the AF&L Building Trades at that time, they had that master agreement, you see, covering everything. And the company opposed this action of the miners, and what happened was that Murphy pulled out of there with my mill, and that the Tunnel and Rock Workers was set up, and Murphy made a deal with the AF&L Building Trades Council at that time that he'd pull out of Camano, provided they'd support him when he'd be taken on steel at Trail, which did happen. This all happened. That can be verified by what happened at Trail. The AF&L unions, that is the Building Trades Council, they supported Mine Mill in their fight with the steelworkers in Trail. And this is where the deal was made. Murphy Piggott was going to have to fight the steelworkers in Trail. And so, sort of to strengthen his hand for the future, he made this deal that they'd support him and he'd pull out of Camano. He'd no longer try and take over the tunnel workers so there. Now, there are many other aspects, you know, of the union and what has happened over a period of years. But I would say that the main thing, as I see it, is this, that my mill has become weakened and is just simply in no position to do anything for the workers. They're staying in existence at the expense of the workers. And I think there's also another aspect of it that's very important, and that is its political aspects.
Do you think,
And now the political aspects, as I see it, are this. The big business interest, the mining interest, they're naturally aligned politically to the old line parties and to the Social Credit Party. And right at the moment, to say that Murphy is communist dominated or controlled by the Communist Party, I think you couldn't say anything further from the truth. You couldn't say anything further from the truth than that. I would say that he's dominated by the mining companies. That's who he's dominated by, not the Communist Party. And he has the Communist Party tricked or fooled into supporting him. And I feel that it may not be very long until the Communist Party will be disowning my mill or telling them to go and get into the steelworkers or something of that nature, because in the workers that you talk to, and even people who are members of the Communist Party, they've told me and they've told other organizers of steel that they're disgracing themselves by supporting my mill. That this is their honest opinion, and then why the hell should they do that? And there is quite a big difference of opinion amongst themselves, I know, on this question of mine mill. And I think the general opinion of the members of the Communist Party right out here in BC is that they are themselves of the opinion that they're disgracing themselves by supporting mine mill, but I understand that their leadership down east, it tells them that they must support my mill.
Do you think that they got a deal with Social Credit? Or they're in good terms?
Well, No, I don't think the Communist Party has.
No, I mean,
Murphy definitely.
Murphy.
Oh, definitely. If he isn't paid by the employers or something to that effect, it will be one of the greatest surprises of my life, you know, because the political aspects of it is this, that he has supported every party under the sun excepting the NDP.
Mm.
Now, years ago, when the fight was whether to affiliate to the CCM or adopt what we call non-partisan political action policy, that was quite a bit different than opposing the NDP today.
Mm-hmm.
And I can well remember when the Mine Mill Conventions adopted this policy of a non-partisan political action policy, and many of the locals on their own, they went out and they supported, they worked for CCF candidates, but they wouldn't affiliate, but they'd gone out and they'd work to support them. Now what Murphy has done, he has done everything under the sun to oppose the CCF and particularly to oppose the NDP. And this is one of the things where I differed with him. I told him that, I said, Murphy, under no circumstances am I going to oppose the NDP. I said, I may not agree with each and every item that is in their policy, but I will not oppose them, and that's all there is to it. And I found out that throughout the province, what they have done, they have sabotaged it, particularly at election times.
Like the internal by-election.
Yes, and non-registration of voters is the big thing. See, like over in these different areas where there's just a mine mill local,
mm-hmm.
the non-registration of voters is very, very important. And now this Britannia hoax, the political aspects there are this, that is a social credit riding. Mine mill controls that riding.
Mm-hmm.
They control it by virtue of the members that they have at Britannia and at Braylorn and Pioneer. Mm-hmm. Now what they do is this, they sabotage the NDP, which elects the social credit. They do not come on out and work openly against the NDP, or very little of it, but they sabotage their efforts, which elects the NDP.
How did they do that?
Oh, by primarily non-registration of voters.
Well, they go out and say, don't register. Then.
Oh, it's just never mentioned.
I see.
It's just never mentioned. It's just ignored. Now, I noticed that in 1963, the last year I worked for them over at SUK, the number that was on the voters list there from the mine, I think there was about two or three people on the voters list out of 120 working at the mine. Up at Port McNeil, out of a camp of around 100, five or six on the voters list. And up at the Western Mines, there was not one, there was no polling booth up there at all. There was nobody on the voters list. And this is something that definitely has to be kept in mind. It has to be watched. It's of extreme importance. And when these people are not registered, that is, the working people are not registered. On the other hand, we see where the mine managers, the accountants there at the mine, so on, they make sure they register all their supporters and they don't give a hoot about anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when this takes place, it has the effect of helping. It has the effect of helping
social credit,
or a liberal or a conservative candidate. Murphy's been making these here deals with the old line parties for years and years. And the employers, what do they see in the Steelworkers Union? They not only see a union that's capable of backing the workers up, but they see a union that supports the NDP. And they know bloody well that at least the Steelworkers Union will do, it will be out registering people to vote and so on. And it will make the difference of at least two or three seats in this year province, or maybe more than that. And you see, there's a good many people have had many differences of opinion with Murphy over this same question, and a lot of them, they never brought it out into the open because they found themselves in a union. They wanted to try and live with one another the best way that they could. But I do know that this has been going on for quite some time. Open collusion with the old line political parties. And I think that the preservation of Mine Mill and the carrying on of Mine Mill in the manner that it has existed for the last several years, it's nothing else but an attempt to turn back the clock about 30 to 50 years is how it is. And I find out that their policy is completely reversed from that of a policy of a militant union to now nothing better than a company union. And when I'm looking at this here book here, it just reminds me now the lawyers that they have hired in Vancouver at the present time to fight their cases for them is a firm called Woolhauser and Tupper. They're one of the oldest legal firms in the city, and I don't think there's any firm that's known to be more conservative than Woolhauser and Tupper. Now that is a firm of lawyers that the employers used against us back in 1946. I'm sure it's right here. I have it marked here. Woolhauser and Tupper, and they used this firm of lawyers against us back in 1946. When I was up at the Taku mine at that time, and they used them for several years. That is the mining companies. This was the firm of lawyers that they used against us. And now, today though, this is the firm of lawyers that Mine Mill is using in their fight with steelworkers and so on. That's one of the examples of that.
Conducted by the Workers' Unity League, and the organizer, who was Indy Antiochs at that time, was Tom Bradley. Now, just where you could locate him here in Vancouver, I'm not too sure, but I think you could find him fairly easy. That was the Antioch strike, 33.
Do you know anything more about that?
Well, yes, I was 18 miles away at that particular time, and I can remember, being told about what did happen there. They went out on strike, that is, the mine went out on strike, and they worked down below at the smelter at the beach, it was called. And company, they asked for a truce of 48 hours, postponed it for 48 hours. The miners wouldn't do it. And then during this here period, they brought in the police, and they had battleships which were sitting out at the entrance to the Antiochs, so to speak, and all boats that came in or out, they were checked at that time. And then they did, they scabbed Antiochs, they operated the mine with scabs after they drove the miners out. And there was a whole number of miners there that were beat up by the police. There was a whole number of miners blacklisted as a result of that strike. And I remember them trying to recruit scabs at Allen's Arm, and I don't think there was any, well, there was nobody from Allen's Arm went to work there, and at Stewart. I don't think there was anybody from Stewart went to work there either. The only, I think there was one from Alice Arm and one from Antioch, were young people that didn't know any better and they weren't living at home, and their parents, they forced them into it, or they lied to them and they got them to go to work there. But other than that, there was nobody scammed from Alice Arm or any of them. And I remember at Alice Arm at that time, there was all of the single fellows on relief. They cut them off relief and they told them jobs were available for them at Antioch. Not one of them would go to work there. And then they got in touch with the union at Prince Rupert, and the union down there sent them enough food to tide them over until such times as they were forced to call the strike off. It wasn't long after that that Antioch closed down, and of course the people went all over the province.
Any other things you know about the workers' union again?
No. I wasn't connected with the Workers' Unity League. The Workers' Unity League, it was responsible for initiating, organizing in a number of other industries and other places across Canada. I believe they were also responsible for initiating the Flin Flon strike, the miners' strike at Flin Flon. And then, of course, they disbanded later on, you know. And they advised all of their members to go into the unions that were already in existence. And this argument, so I am told, it's one of the arguments that's being used in amongst the communists themselves on this issue of mine mill and steel workers. They say the argument that they put up is, that is a number of them, they say, well, mine mill has been beat, it can't do anything. What's wrong with them? Get back in there in the mainstream of the labor movement where they can do something. And what they done with the Workers' Unity League, as I said, this is an example that they tell me they use.
You said something about Bent River. You were there when they organized the union. This is in what, 30?
Bridge River? No, I wasn't in Bridge River when they went out on strike.
When was this?
This was in 35. And that's the time when I left there and I went into the Nelson country. Well, in 35, they had a strike there which only lasted just a couple of days, and the miners got exactly what they wanted.
And how did this come about?
It came about as a result of the miners getting together and deciding to go on out on strike. And an offshoot of that was the setting up of Mine Mill Local 271.
When?
It would be in the fall, I guess, of 1935 or the spring of 1936. Because it was in the winter.
So they set up that would be one of the first locals.
Yes. Now that was the first local of Mine Mill that was set up since the disintegration of the Western Federation of Miners back in the First World War. Mm-hmm. That was the first local that was set up.
And was it purely a local initiative?
I beg your pardon?
Was it purely in the local initiative, the local miners?
I would say so. I would say so. Now, I was just trying to think of the names of some of the fellows
who may have been up there at that time. There are fellows up at Bray Lauren that was in there at that time that could give you this exact history and the, you know, the chain of events. Larson is the name of one fella. He's still at Bray Lauren. And that would be regarding the 1935 strike and the chartering of mine mill local 271. And another fellow, he is a retired miner, Glenn Osborne. Now, he is either living in Vancouver or living in Kamloops. And incidentally, Osborne is one of the members of this Grand Duke Disaster Fund. That's the fellow. And Glenn Osborne.
And what is, he was in the same thing?
Yes, yes, yes. He was in that. Now there are others that were in it that I knew, but of course they're out of there. And there would still be other old timers up in that valley. They'd be able to fill you in on the events there.
Well, I think that just about covers it.
Yes. Now you were mentioning that we were mentioning Tom Bradley, and on the logging, you have already made your contacts on the logging, I guess.
Well, not that many, actually.
Oh, now, you people, you interviewed Harold Pichette, have you?
No. I'll just put that down. Logging.
Logging.
But I've got a note of him anyway.
There'd be Harold Pichette. And there's another old timer, John McCush.
John?
Now,
how do you spell that?
That's MC, capital C, UISH. Now, he's an old member of the IWW, John McCush.
Mm-hmm.
He's quite a bit older man than Harold Pichette.
He was in the IWW, right?
Yeah, he was in the IWW.
In the Larkin camps?
Yes, yeah, yeah. In fact, this John McCush would be I'll tell you what, if I can locate old John or find somebody that knows his address,
yes.
I'll phone it into you.
Phone us up to Fed.
Yeah.
Okay.
And now I know that
that'd be a good man to get a hold of.
Yes, John McCush would be your ideal man to get a hold of as far as the logging is concerned. And on the Workers' Unity League, Tom McEwen, of course.
Yeah. Do you know anybody else that was in the IWW?
Can't think of them right on the spur of the moment. Not too many of them around nowadays, you know. I know one of the former IWW organizers back in the 1920s. He's living at Alice Arm now.
What's his name?
Morris Peterson.
He's M-O-R-R-S?
Yes, M-O-R-R-I-S.
Uh-huh. Peterson.
Yeah, Peterson. He's living at Alice Arm.
Is that Ian or Owen?
Gosh, that I'm not too
mm-hmm.
sure.
Yeah,
he is a man that well, Morris is getting up in years now. was thinking that a person might be able to get some information from him by writing to him, you know. And I don't know, he's getting to the age where he's shaky, you know, hard for him to write. Now Frank Calder knows Morris Peterson. I'm quite sure Frank Calder knows Morris Peterson. And sometime when Calder goes into Alice Arm, it's an idea that you might be able to get him to interview Morris. Now the last time I was into Alice Arm, and I was talking to Morris about the IWW, and well, he was reminiscing, and he was quite bitter about how, you know, working people never stick together. He said it was always that way, and you know, and things like that. But he didn't go into any details. But he used to be an organizer for them in the area, I believe, from Prince George to Prince Rupert, back in the 1920s and early 30s. And then with a lot of those fellows, you know, they get blackballed and they'll have to go and settle in some other part of the country or the world where they're not known. And in order to make a living, well, they have to keep all of their sympathies to themselves. And I guess this is what happened to Morris Peterson, and the same way as it happened to this George Casey, you know, that I was telling you about from Rosslyn, who settled in Prince Rupert, and one of his son-in-laws happened to be George Hill, who was a CCF candidate up there several years ago.
Well,
but that gives you a little bit more on it.